good horse, I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune.
That brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
How oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're listening to episode 593 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. That was the most famous part of Mario Savio's speech in the 60s to striking students, which sets a context for this show's title, Let Your Life Be a Friction, which is also the title of the first piece, which is a video by Class War Films. Thank you to Chaz K for sending this my way. It's a perfect introduction to a couple of other pieces that I had lined up, which is an interview with the woman who started the Ploughshares Actions in the UK, Angie Zelter, who inspired thousands of people to take direct action to damage and destroy some of Britain's nuclear weapons. In our second hour, we're going to be hearing about more direct action, this time to stop airport runways, and we're also going to have some warning words about some less than direct action by Canadian NGOs partnering with big business. And we're going to conclude with another reading from Chapter 7 of David Graeber. So, this is the soundtrack of the video, Let Your Life Be a Friction, which, as usual, we will link in from the show's webpage.
Nightmare and insanity are akin. Mysterious and involuntary states that skew and distort objective reality. One wakens from nightmare. From insanity, there is no awakening. Whether Americans live in the one state or the other is the paramount question of this era. For 200 years, Americans have been indoctrinated with a mythology created, imposed, and sustained by a manipulating cabal, a financial elite that built its absolute control on the muscle and blood, ignorance, and credulity of its citizenry. It has now metastasized into the corporate tyranny that owns and controls America. America began with the invasion of a populated continent and the genocide of its people. Once entrenched, it embraced enslavement of another race. With those pillars of state in place, it declared itself an independent nation in a testament that proclaimed the equality of all mankind. In that monumental act of hypocrisy, America's myth had its genesis. A constitution was written that came to be regarded as Holy Writ. Designed by men of wealth and prominence, its central purposes were to defend private property and suppress mass democracy. It has fulfilled those mandates beyond the dreams of its creators. With the existing oligarchy secure in law and native people largely exterminated, the ruling class increased its wealth and power fantastically in the 19th century, using the government as its enabler, exploiting to the limit the device of chartered corporations. So empowered, the financial elite used the military to expand its sway beyond the continent. Regions, territories, islands, and whole countries were annexed, invaded, and possessed outright, their peoples crushed, suppressed, and exploited. Because ordinary Americans, like any people, need to believe that whatever the ruling class undertakes in their name must be essentially benevolent, noble in purpose, and justified in fact, the American myth had to be radically modified for imperial expansion. The foundational myth was that the Americans had come to a howling wilderness teeming with godless savages, and through invincible strength of character and purity of purpose had tamed the land and honorably earned the right to possess their bountiful home. In the era of extraterritorial expansion, that version was polished to justify and ennoble imperialism. The new corollary was that America was obliged by our manifest destiny to carry our mission into barbaric darkness wherever tyranny created abuse and suffering. A national myth that absolutely binds the loyalty of a people to its government must be a subtle and powerful elixir that elevates and aggrandizes that people's self-regard. National policy will then appear to be an extension of its superior citizenry's inchoate will and an instrument of justified arrogance toward the lesser world. The simple, powerful myth of America's heroic and altruistic benevolence, shaped by the financial elite, infused Americans with a hubristic belief in their racial superiority that mobilized gave imperialist enterprises the character of a quasi-religious crusade. In this way, insatiable imperialism acquired the apparent moral perfection of a syllogism. With World War II, the world was reconfigured. American capitalism emerged supreme from the horror that had virtually wrecked its capitalist partners. The Soviet Union, though, in spite of having absorbed much the greatest devastation of all from Nazi Germany, rose astonishingly from its ruin to become the sole rival to America as a world power. This challenge was not competitive, it was systemic. Soviet communism was a direct threat to American hegemony in that it categorically refuted the philosophical basis of predatory capitalism. Grounded in Marx and Lenin, it attacked capitalism's inherent evils, monstrous inequities, and flagrant injustices that, when exacerbated by speculation, exploitation, and fraud, would eventually destroy it. And it promoted world revolution to that end. The Cold War required further refinement of the American myth. Instead of simply intervening where circumstances supposedly demanded that we impose our system, America now had to be the shield and bulwark of the sacred capitalist system in which free enterprise, magically identified with democracy, was equally to be defended. This version held through many surrogate confrontations in the era of mutually assured destruction, and survived even the debacle of Vietnam, lasting until the collapse of the Soviet Union. On radio and television, Americans were subjected to an unrelenting barrage of hyper-patriotism, in which American moral superiority was a given, and America's self-touted courage, generosity, and decency were its unchallengeable proofs. The implosion of the Soviet Union left America, in its own terms, the sole superpower in a unipolar world, which required further retooling of the myth. The practical effect of having no doomsday enemy, China wouldn't do yet, was to supercharge its element of pure hubristic ego. America was no longer just the defender of the free world from heresy. It was now, by virtue of its glorious self-touted exceptionalism, required to oversee and police it in the interests and for the benefit of all. Power tends to corrupt, said Lord Acton. An absolute power corrupts absolutely. When the only rival to American power disintegrated, our ruling elite saw the opportunity for the first time in history for one country to absolutely dominate and control the world. This consensus was expressed in a policy statement by major hard right-wing political players titled The Project for a New American Century. This triumphalist manifesto laid out a plan for absolute American access to and control of essential resources and raw materials worldwide, guaranteed by our military enforcing full-spectrum dominance. The American myth, which had lost some momentum in the totally unexpected so-called Cold War victory, was now re-energized with a proactive essence and endowed with a glowing radiance of a true and, for the first time, self-professed imperial mission. The attack on the towers, an unimaginable provocation, was the trigger mechanism for the explosive launch of the effort to impose that imperial model in practice on the world. It has been without question the most spectacular failure in the history of American misadventure. After a decade marked by the waste of trillions of dollars and thousands of American lives, the stunning bankruptcy of our internally burglarized nation, and a consequent recession more fundamentally damaging than the Great One, Imperial America has nothing to show for the astonishing folly of its arrogant overreach, but unequivocal disasters in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, with no end of madness in sight. It is clear that the hypnotic hold of the American myth on the loyalty of the people has led only to disgrace and tragedy, and set a course to inevitable imperial decline and ruin. This truth, though, entirely mistakes the purpose of the myth. It was never intended to serve either our country or our people. It was created solely to shield, buttress, and exalt the financial ruling class. It has done that with complete and astonishing success. As a prime example, the massive looting of funding for the Iraq-Afghanistan-Pakistan wars to enrich the corporate tyranny is on a unique scale of its own, without anything remotely comparable to its flagrant obscenity in the whole long history of war. Neither the Pentagon nor the government can account for the billions of dollars that have vanished there. There is no doubt that beyond the outrageously inflated no-bid contracts given to giant corporations with their obscene guaranteed profits, much of the money was simply stolen by, through, or in spite of the military, and distributed among thieves and accomplices. Much of it came in bricks on huge pallets, for convenience, presumably. As this wholesale corporate robbery was in progress under military oversight abroad, the corporate tyranny evolved a new set of impenetrably complex devices for the generation of money without either any economically productive source or result at home. The sole driving force and purpose of capitalism is, of course, the realization of profit. According to that iron calculus, reducing production costs increases profit margin. This leads to the obvious conclusion that as production costs near zero, profit is maximized. There is no provision for social good in capitalist theory. Corporations, created to optimize commercial opportunity through efficient specialization, were originally required to operate for public good, but that provision was quickly finessed and forgotten. American law courts have always favored corporate concentrations of wealth since they, like the Congress, exist to serve moneyed interests. And the judiciary has consistently cooperated in ruling reliably for corporations and against the interests of the people. Indeed, without considering the question in law, the Supreme Court long ago endowed corporations with personhood, that is, with all the rights of human beings under our Constitution. That this travesty occurred as a slipshod clerical error shows that the court preferred to mask this perversion of the intent of the 14th Amendment as an unexamined assumption rather than risk an eventual test which would have created public outrage. Given the collusion of Congress and the courts in securing legal invulnerability for the corporate tyranny, and the fact that corporations' only duty is maximization of profit, it was inevitable that megabanks, huge brokerage houses, giant insurance conglomerates, gilded hedge funds, and credit agencies pretending to certify their work all engaged in massive criminal fraud and deception for just that purpose. The result was the crash of 08, the recession, and the unprecedented bailout of the biggest banks and investment houses with taxpayer dollars. So much for the invisible hand of the free market. In recent years, two related trends have battered the American myth. First, any belief the world had in it has been shattered by a catastrophic series of imbecile military disasters which has eroded its efficacy at home. Second, in response, the state has made crude efforts to boost its waning power by imposing totalitarian-style surveillance, intimidation, and coercion on the American people to a degree unprecedented in scope and scale. The vast, clanking medieval apparatus of homeland security that has sprouted like an enormous poison fungus since 9/11, with its brutal police state mindset, The odious Patriot Act with its flagrant subversions of the Bill of Rights. The endless fantasy-based terror peddling of the prostitute corporate media with its clowns and harpies churning irrational fear and anger in the uninformed. All this grim repressive machinery is a ham-handed attempt to distract Americans from the real causes of their injury, abuse, and oppression. And yet, even with the American myth now exposed for the tissue of lies, deceptions, and frauds that it has always been, it still keeps its phenomenal hold on the great mass of American people. The sad reality is that for the majority, their own identities have been so deeply and thoroughly infused with the myth that to disbelieve it is to disbelieve in themselves. So the dead American myth lives on in its deadness, horribly masking our crapshot economy, our bankrupt debtor's prison of a society, our ghost dance charade of kabuki democracy, while typhoons of impending social, economical, and ecological disaster build their enormous, lightning-charged thunderheads above the dark future before us. And what does the dead myth still obscure? What is beyond the wall of failing deception and dishonesty? What horrors has the shoddy fable so long and effectively concealed? It is a world brutalized by the violence of our imperialist mania. It is the wrecked and pillaged economies looted by our predatory capitalist austerity regimes. It is the hundreds of millions of starved, dying children sacrificed to Wall Street commodities gaming. It is the multitudes of innocent, ignorant people barely surviving under absolutist regimes propped up by our tax dollars, while our banks siphon off profits from arming their brutal police states and bribing their kings, sheikhs, or generals. It is the millions of dead and maimed and raped populations of simple tribal people that our indiscriminately murderous juggernaut has left in its bloody wake in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. It is the bitter and appalling legacy of hate and repulsion, disdain and fear, which America has earned with its hegemonist villainy in every region of the world. And at home, what is it we Americans have been so complicit in hiding from ourselves, in our devotion to the perverse legend that has come to inhabit our souls like an incubus? It is millions of us with no work or hope in middle age whose jobs and homes have been devoured by the sick fraud machine of Wall Street. It is the trash, demolished weed lots of our major cities crumbling in fire-gutted ruin. It is the many cities with industries defunct and factories dismantled and shipped overseas. It is our decaying, defunded public schools, our bankrupt states and counties, our overtaxed, antiquated public transportation systems, our obsolete, dissolving infrastructure, our gigantic and irrational prisons horror, our cynical healthcare con game, and over it all, the jackboot mechanism of our police state, armed and empowered, ready for use against us all. This is where we are. The great question now is whether we can awaken from our long nightmare and face the terrifying and exhilarating prospect of living in reality without the false props and dishonest constructs of a hoodwinked and dishonored people, or whether we have internalized the falsity to such an extent that it has become a collective insanity. In 1846, Henry David Thoreau, offended to his soul by the American invasion of Mexico, protested and went to jail. In his essay on civil disobedience, he said this of state policy: "If injustice is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another, then I say break the law. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine." To attempt to break the death grip of the American myth will be a titanic challenge. To even begin to rebel against the might of the national security state will require the courage to face far more than official disapproval. Imperial America will respond to even the most peaceful and orderly protest with hard police action. And the level of repression will rise with the scope and seriousness of the action undertaken. Small protests will have no effect. Organized mass demonstrations will draw the brutally motivated national security state apparatus down upon them. Americans, excepting our underclass, have no experience with violent police or military repression. Those who commit peaceful civil disobedience will swiftly find to their cost how it works. In a national security state that has eradicated all laws that prevent abuse of the public, whatever the state does is legal. To such a pass have we in America come, as a result of our long historic indoctrination and abject submission to our ruling class. To achieve any redemption for Americans, to make possible any more just, humane, and life-honoring society, will require complete abandonment of the system of predatory capitalism. It offers no prospect of reform or improvement, and we have all been witness to the absurdly corrupt idiocy of our so-called democratic process for generations. America is nearing the greatest crisis point in its history, and the terrific coming cataclysm will determine the future of our country. If we cannot rise in dominating numbers to reject the heartless, mindless, soulless machine of imperial predatory capitalism, we will be condemned to a fascistic command and control horror in which human beings are mere possessions of the state, units of production or service, and then perhaps not even that, as excess population in that brave new world may simply be eliminated. That end is not inevitable. We are not lost. We are not defeated, since to this moment we have not engaged. We have not honored our responsibility as human beings. We have not defended our humanity. We have abjured our power and let ourselves be ruled. All around the world, the rolling thunder of irresistible outrage is now heard and felt. In Egypt and Spain, Syria and Greece, Iraq and Sudan, Afghanistan and Ireland, everywhere the legitimate anger of humanity is fueling an uprising against the dead hand of predatory capitalism and its evils. And in Americans, so long trapped, encapsulated like flies in amber in a false religion of state idolatry, the anger is deep, widespread, and growing. The myth is broken and dead. It is up to those who know and care to lead. Thomas Paine said, "These are the times that try men's souls." Nothing is guaranteed us. That can't matter. We cannot consider odds or outcomes. We simply cannot let the machine of injustice grind on. We must confront with calm courage a vicious tyrannical system that is destroying the earth and its life and its people. We must put our lives on the line to oppose it. And we must do it now. The nightmare machine of rapacious exploitation has overthrown decency and reason, and its bloody human treason flourishes over us. This must be ended. We must end it. Let your life be a friction to stop the machine.
And now we're going to hear from a woman whose chosen mission was stopping nuclear weapons in the UK. This is Angie Zelter, as interviewed in December 2010 by Mike McCormack of Talking Stick TV.
We're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Angie Zelter. Angie Zelter is a British peace activist. She is founder of a number of international campaign groups, including Trident Plowshares, which was a recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize. She is also co-founder of the International Women's Peace Service, In the 1980s, she founded the Snowball Campaign, which encouraged several thousand people to cut the fences around U.S. military bases in the U.K. In 1996, she was part of a group that disarmed a Hawk jet, ZH-955, causing 1.5 million pounds of damage and preventing it from being exported to Indonesia, where it would have been used to attack East Timor. She is also author of several books, Fastlane 365, A Year of Anti-Nuclear Blockades, and Trident on Trial, The Case for People's Disarmament. So start out and give some background on yourself. How did you get becoming involved as an activist?
Well, I was at university, and the last year at university, I read Blueprint for Survival, which was the first issue of a magazine called The Ecologist. And in it, it talked about all sorts of things that I'd never come across, like acid rain and global warming and nuclear weapons and all sorts of things. And I thought, how could I have done a whole university degree and not come across all of these vital issues? And then after my degree, when I finished, I went to Africa with my husband, to Cameroon, and we were working in community development. And I realized that racism still existed. And that we had a class system. In other words, I came from a very apolitical background, and I suddenly realized that there were a lot of big issues out there. After 3 years in Cameroon, well, let me say, when I was in Cameroon, after I'd been there a year, a guy said to me, a Cameroonian guy, he said, "What are you here for?" And I said, "Well, I've always wanted to come and help third world countries." And he said, "Help? What do you mean help?" He said, "If you want to help us, go back to Britain and deal with why we're poor here. Basically, your countries are ripping us off. You're exploiting all our resources." And I said, "You're dead right. You're absolutely right." So after the 3 years, we had an option of renewing our contract. And I said to my husband, "You know, I think we should go back, because that's where the root of a lot of the issues and the problems in the world are coming from. They're coming from our colonialist country." So when I got back, it was in the late 70s, early 80s. And of course, at that time, the main issue was nuclear weapons. So I got involved in demonstrating and collecting signatures for a world disarmament petition, and got involved that way. And it's not stopped really since, because Britain's still involved in exploitation and wars, and still has a huge carbon footprint, and is still, as far as I can see, ripping off the world because of the financial structures.
Yeah, it's looking like you've still got your work cut out for you for the foreseeable
future. I don't think it's going to end, probably. A lot of these issues have been going on for a long time, and they need more and more of us to be tackling them.
So did the Snowball Campaign come before Trident Plowshares?
Yes, that was part of the 80s. That was when we were the U.S. aircraft carrier for Europe. It was during the Cold War, and many of us realized that actually Britain had a huge number of U.S. bases with nuclear weapons as well. And Greenham Common, I expect most people have heard of Greenham Common. The missiles were coming over, and they were in Europe as well. I went to Greenham Common. I think it was probably one of my first arrests, actually, the women's peace movement there, which was trying to stop the US missiles being based there, the cruise missiles. That radicalized me and made me realize that ordinary women could stand up against this mostly masculine military industrial complex. And also, there were thousands of women going into the local courts there, and they were doing their court cases in very many different ways. And I realized that there wasn't one way to protest or one way to try to get rid of these things. Each person had to find their own voice and could do it in their own way. And there was a message at Greenham which said, "Carry Greenham home." Now, at that time, I had a young family. I had two young children. We lived in an extended family in Norfolk, and it was quite a long way from the Greenham base, so I decided to take that message, "Carry Greenham home." And we had quite a few U.S. bases in East Anglia, and so I started the Snowball Civil Disobedience Campaign in my local area. And what it was basically encouraging people to just find two other people to take part as well, to write letters to the government asking them to take one small step towards disarmament, and that they would commit themselves to just cutting one strand of fence around a U.S. base. Now, that sounds incredibly symbolic, but it was criminal damage, and therefore people were going into court to explain why they had cut one strand of fence. So what we were doing was very little, And what we were asking the government to do was also quite little. It was just saying, just take one step towards nuclear disarmament. There's many things that you could do, just one step. And I think several thousand people were arrested during that campaign. And there were a lot of discussions about, you know, vandalism and, you know, why should people be committing criminal damage and, you know, was it right? Was that a violent act or was it not a violent act? Loads of public discussion about that. And I think that that was a very useful campaign because it made people realize that criminal damage and vandalism is more about the intent and what the consequences of that is and what you're doing it for. It isn't just about whether you're damaging something or not. Because, for instance, if you're rebuilding your house or your garage, you might knock it down and then rebuild something. You don't call the knocking down vandalism or criminal damage, do you? You call that part of a creative process of rebuilding. And what we were saying was that we were cutting down the fences because we wanted to transform them. We wanted these bases to go away and we wanted to have something that was more sustainable and more humane. We didn't want these nuclear weapons there.
And it sounds like that, in fact, by actually physically doing something, taking that step, that that helped your court cases as opposed to if you, they hadn't done anything, you know.
Well, we were in those days in the '80s, we were not winning those cases. They were basically rather symbolic because, and what we were being told in the court is, you're just doing this for public attention. You know, you're not doing anything. You're just wanting to get into the news or something. And we were saying, no, sorry, what we're trying to do here is to sort of bring things into the light. We're trying to show people that these weapons of mass destruction are here. And it was in the process of that that I started learning about international law and realizing that actually it wasn't just a moral and ethical and humane action. It wasn't, we weren't only doing these for moral reasons, but actually that the law was on our side as well. And that morality, I started thinking about the law and morality. And of course, the whole purpose of the law really is to protect the innocent and the weak and to protect society so that we don't all have to go around carrying guns. I know I'm in a gun culture here, but remember, I come from Europe. We don't have a gun culture there. We're not allowed guns, thank God, on our streets. You can only have a gun with a license for a very specific purpose. And the reason we don't have guns, you know, because obviously in the past some people did, was that we rely on the law to protect us. So if something's going wrong, you go to go through the courts or you go to your police and they sort it out. So everybody doesn't have to go around doing that. Kind of getting lost now, really, but I think I was just trying to say that the morality and the law is very strong, and if the law isn't linked to morality, then it loses, in a way, its legitimacy. And when we discovered that the international law was on our side, and actually there already were laws on an international level to prevent us all having, you know, weapons, and that... Then we had something that we could argue in court as well, and that led on to other campaigns. But at the snowball stage in the 80s, it was just simply a civil disobedience campaign, and we were just beginning to learn more about international law in those days.
And it sounds like it had some success because eventually it sounds like most of the U.S. bases are now out of the UK.
Well, interesting. I mean, Greenham Common was the big success story, I think, because thousands and thousands of women went there over quite a few years, and the protests weren't just in Britain, but they were across the whole of Europe. We did manage to get rid of the Pershing missiles in Germany, from Eastern Germany, and also from the cruise missiles from Britain. So Greenham Common, that one. The getting rid of the U.S. nuclear weapons has taken much longer, and it's only been in the last couple of years that we've realized that we have succeeded there. And from the documents that we've seen on the internet, because you get a lot more freedom of information in the U.S. than we do in the U.K., which is quite a secretive society, it seems that it was because there were so many protests at Lakenheath, which is near where I was living, and the U.S. military just couldn't stop the number of protesters getting into the high security nuclear weapons depots in Lakenheath, that they've now withdrawn nuclear weapons from Lakenheath. So we don't any longer have US nuclear weapons in Britain, which is great. But of course, we do still have UK nuclear weapons, and they're all based in Scotland. And that's what I've been concentrating on for the last sort of 6 or 7 years. Well, actually, no, in Scotland for the last 12 years with Trident Plowshares.
Can you briefly talk about the Hawk jet that you were involved with?
Okay, yeah, that was 1996. That was my first Plowshares action. And if we put it in context, that was in the context of a huge British arms trade, which we still have, which is basically selling weapons wherever it can and to repressive regimes. So while it's talking about democracy and support for people, it's actually encouraging an arms trade. And there's no real controls on that arms trade. So although they pretend that they wouldn't sell them to, repressive regimes, they do sell them. And at that time, they were selling them to Suharto, who'd already killed millions of Indonesians and who'd occupied East Timor and had killed 200,000 people, a third of the population of East Timor. And these Hawk jets were produced by British Aerospace, which is one of our major arms industries. And we had evidence through a film done by John Pilger that you might have heard of, that they had been decimating tribes and actually committing genocide. Whole tribes, distinct, unique tribes of people in East Timor had been wiped out by the use of these Hawk jets. There had been a large campaign against, there is a great organization in Britain called the Campaign Against the Arms Trade. They've been doing a lot on trying to stop the arms trade. But a small group of us got together and decided that if we couldn't do it by letter writing and demonstrations then, which we would continue to try to do, then if this particular batch in 1995-96 were going to be exported, we would try to prevent that export by damaging as many of them as we could. So a group of 10 women prepared for a year. We went to see British Aerospace. We lobbied our parliament. We wrote letters. We did everything that we could do as an ordinary citizen to try to prevent the arms trade, along with other, hundreds of thousands of people in Britain writing letters. And then just before this particular Hawk jet was due to be exported, four of our group of 10 became open disarmers. Three of them went in. I remained on the outside to do the publicity and then do a second run if the first run hadn't run. And we were the four open disarmers. We'd already done a film to indict the government and put all the evidence together. We wrote a booklet about it because we knew that we faced maybe 10 years in prison, and we wanted to make sure that the information got to the jury because we were going to stand by our action and we wanted to explain it adequately. 1.5 million pounds worth of damage was done to the Hawk jet at the British Aerospace factory at Wharton. And four of us were picked up and kept in prison for 6 months in high security prison. And then we got to court and we were able to explain to the jury what had happened. It was touch and go because the particular judge, I was slightly separate from the others because I'd been picked up later on. And I had a hidden court case, okay, and I was representing myself, so there were no lawyers on my side. I got to this first hearing, and the judge said to me, "Women like you should be locked up for a very long time." And I was quite shocked that a judge would say that to me. I said, what are you saying? I hope you're not going to be the judge that's going to represent us, because I consider that a very biased remark. And he said, "Yes, I will be your judge." I was absolutely shocked. So he showed his true colours. In a way, the fact that he was such a revoltingly biased judge showed through, and the jury could see that too. Because one of our witnesses in that case was José Ramos Horta, who later got the Nobel Peace Prize. He was in exile, and East Timorese in exile, and we managed to get him to our court case. And when he came in to explain what those Hawk jets had been done to the jury, the judge was absolutely disgusting with him. And when he was he'd been asked a question about what damage had these Hawk jets done, as if they'd done none, and he was trying to explain. And the judge just said, answering yes or no. He just didn't want this information to come out. And he was kind of humiliated, publicly humiliated, or the judge tried to humiliate him and tried to make him out to be a liar. And he went, because I wasn't represented, I could do what I like in the trial to some extent. So I just stood up and I apologized as he went out. And I said, "I apologize for the behavior of that judge, because I know and I feel for what those East Timorese, you as East Timor, have suffered And I think those sort of things that kept on coming in the trial influenced the jury. And the fact that they had the video and they had the booklet, because they'd been on all of us when we'd all been arrested and were left by the damaged plane. And so although the judge said that to the jury that we obviously didn't have a defense and we should be found guilty, the jury found us not guilty. And that was an amazing, amazing feeling of success. And, of course, José Ramos Horta and Bishop Bello, the East Timorese, went on to get the Peace Prize, and East Timor did become independent. One of the nicest things about that was while we were in prison waiting, we had a smuggled letter from an East Timorese that came out of an Indonesian jail that said, we've heard about it even though we're inside an Indonesian jail, and we thank you for downing a plane without any loss of life.
All right, so talk about Trident Plowshares and the Trident system in the UK. Is it, I assume the Trident subs are similar to the ones here in the US?
They're very similar, yes. And the Trident missiles that we use are actually leased from the US. And in fact, in Britain, we actually say, look, we haven't got an independent deterrent. What's all this about? It's actually based on, you know, on the American system. And so we lease our missiles from the US, and there's obviously a huge interchange, and you'll find thousands of US scientists working at Aldermaston on the replacement for the Trident missiles at our Aldermaston, which is our bomb-making factory, which is against the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Any renewal of any nuclear weapons is against the Non-Proliferation Treaty, because we promised when we signed that treaty that we would involve ourselves in nuclear disarmament. That was our deal. For no other countries getting nuclear weapons, we would all disarm, which we haven't done. So we're breaking the law there. So there's a big connection between the US and the UK system. All of our nuclear weapons now are based on these Trident submarines, and they're based in Scotland. And the majority of the Scottish public, 85%, are against nuclear weapons and want the nuclear weapons out of Scotland. And we now have a Scottish National Party in power that would like to get rid of those nuclear weapons. But the Westminster is saying that's a devolved power, that is something that only the UK government can decide, and they're ignoring the whole, you know, the Scottish context, if you like. Trident Plowshare started 12 years ago, quite small. We didn't know what we would face because we thought we might, you know, it would be difficult to get people to do disarmament actions. We might face 10 years or so in prison. But we decided that we would get as many people signed up to personally try to disarm in a non-violent manner the nuclear weapon system. We wrote a handbook. We took a year to do that. We made our names public. We sent them to the government, and we said, if you do not engage in nuclear disarmament within a certain time limit, then we will start publicly and non-violently disarming the nuclear system. And in our handbook, we had lots of stuff on non-violence and the Plowshares movement and Trident, the Trident system, but also a map of or a diagram of the Trident submarine and where it would be safe to disarm it and how to disarm it. And how not to disarm it. In other words, don't go near the nuclear reactors, don't cut electrical wires that go here, you know, to make sure that we would do it in a way that wouldn't harm anybody. That was actually leaked to the press just before the time limit was up and we started. So I actually got a call from the commander at Baslane Base asking for one of these handbooks. So I charged him £10 for it. So that was quite interesting. And we started with several hundred people and started cutting through fences and swimming across lochs and trying to get near the submarines. And it's gone on from there. And several thousand people have been arrested and quite a few serious disarmament actions have taken place. And quite a few victories have been won in the court as well.
You appear to get a lot more people participating in your Plowshares work there in the UK and Scotland than we do here in the US. How do you account for that?
I don't know whether it's more or less, but I think It's more secular, the movement. In when Trident Plowshares started, we knew that the Plowshares movement in the USA was mostly Christian based, and we decided that we would make it for anybody of faith or of no faith, secular or whatever, because basically all religions and all people, if they're really human, share a basic ethical framework, which you don't harm people, you know. That murder is wrong, you know, you don't steal. Well, the basic ethical foundation, I think, of all societies is very similar. So we wanted to base it on that. And we also wanted to base it very firmly on international law and delegitimize nuclear weapons, because basically they're terror weapons, they're weapons of mass destruction, and they completely dehumanize us and destroy the integrity of our societies and the moral framework for our societies. Because if you're willing to threaten mass murder, then what can you say about an ordinary murderer in the street, you know? And the only thing that distinguishes a soldier from a murderer is that he is given permission by society to do legalized killing, and the killing has to be done in a certain way and under a certain legal framework, and that is international humanitarian law, which says that you don't target, for instance, women and children, or hospitals, or cultural artifacts. You don't, you know, destroy the environment forever. That the killing of your, you know, of your soldiers must be done within that framework. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're just letting loose, you know, a sort of non-ending violence. Which is where I think we've got to today, because the, you know, USA and the UK and the major nuclear powers, the powerful nations, are not obeying those international laws. We're seeing more and more wars and more civilians getting killed all the time. I mean, just look at Iraq, look at Afghanistan. You know, the quantity of civilian infrastructure damage and the number of, you know, millions of ordinary men, women and children that have been killed there is outrageous. You know, that isn't war according to international law, where soldier is meant to fight soldier. You know, it's just gone beyond that. So Trident Plowshares is basing itself on international law and encouraging people to be involved in non-violent direct action to disarm nuclear weapons themselves, because our governments and police and courts are not doing it for us. And the reason why probably we can get more people doing that is that the implications in the court are less than here. In Britain, we do have a jury system, and we are allowed generally to give a full defence. So we have, I think, a fairer legal system here than you do here. I've heard, for instance, that the Tacoma people, the people that are up in Tacoma Court on Tuesday next week, are being disallowed their defence, are not going to be allowed expert witnesses, and that the prosecution, I don't know what you call them here, but anyway, the prosecutors,
yeah,
are trying to prevent them from even talking about the lethality of nuclear weapons, which is core to their argument. Because, I mean, obviously, the whole reason that they went in there was because these nuclear weapons threaten, you know, the peace of the whole world. They threaten actually all life on Earth, because there's more than 20,000 nuclear weapons, you know, within, was it 20 miles of Seattle? You know, I think it's a large...
It's 20 miles away.
Yeah.
It's the largest repository of nuclear weapons in the Western Hemisphere,
more than
if not 2,000
nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Is it 2,300 or something, nuclear weapons, something like that?
We're not positive.
I think it's the largest conglomeration of nuclear weapons anywhere in the whole world.
Yeah. If that county became its own country, it would be the world's largest nuclear weapons. Yeah.
And they're not allowed to talk about that, and yet that is key to their defense. In Britain, we are allowed to talk to it, which means that the jury gets gets the truth and the whole truth, which is what we pledge to do in court, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We're allowed to do that to a larger extent than you are, and therefore we tend to get fines or acquittals or very small imprisonments, whereas here American citizens have been very brave to do what they do, because some of them have been in prison for years for what we would maybe only get a £100 fine for or something.
How is the media in the UK? Do they cover your events? Do they cover it with any sense of balance?
In Scotland, they've been covering it. In England, no. They tend to go for the personal story or the kind of, I don't know, they don't discuss the issues. I mean, I worry about the way that the media don't allow the real issues to be explained and talked about, which then just trivializes the whole discussion. Alternative media are much better, and now that there is the internet, people can get the information if they really want to.
And how has you've been doing this for quite a while now, has the climate changed in both public opinion and media since you first began doing this?
Yes. I mean, our Hawkjet action was the first Ploughshares action that had ever, where we ever got an acquittal, where we were found not guilty. And since then, there have been actions in Scotland and in Ireland and in England, and we've won. You know, there was a recent disarmament action against the export of weapons to Israel during the last Gaza incursion, which killed so many people there. And they were allowed to give their defense and explain what Israel had been doing, and they won their case. I think the general public, when juries are given the information, we're getting a lot more acquittals. I think the public opinion is now turning against this whole war machine. I think people are realizing that we've been doing this for thousands of years. It's getting us absolutely nowhere. Violence just causes violence. We have to deal with the root causes. And one of the root causes is the financial structures. We have to take back the power from the banks. We have to create, governments need to create money on credit. We have to take away the power of the corporations, make corporations responsible and liable for what they do. And then that will maybe take away the money imperative, that the money kind of, which is driving this whole military-industrial complex. And the other thing that people mustn't forget is that the US military, for instance, actually uses more than 50% of the carbon resources of the world. It is the major contributor to climate change. And that is kept out of the equations. It's not talked about at Cancun and anything because of various international agreements in the past. We have to stop the military.
So with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
And as if to underline the importance of actually physically doing things, not subscribing to a campaign or sending money in people's direction, I'm going to hear a recent recording. This is Gwen Shulman about a story she broke, the teaming up of Canadian environmental NGOs with large mining corporations.
All right, right now I am joined with Gwen Shulman, who wrote her first article for the Media Co-op, but before that she's been hosting a show on CKUT based out of Montreal called Amandala, which looks at African issues. So thank you very much for coming on the show, Gwen.
No, my pleasure.
So basically the article that you co-wrote for the Media Co-op was kind of concerning this alliance between NGOs, the three leading NGOs and the three leading Canadian mining companies.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the first thing is break down what exactly this partnership means and what does it entail exactly?
Okay, well, I mean, just technically what it is that CETA announced back in September, the Canadian International Development Agency, announced that it was making $26.7 million available to joint projects that would be led by Canadian NGOs in collaboration with Canadian mining companies. So specifically, we're talking about Plan Canada teaming up with IAMGOLD in Burkina Faso to the tune of $7.6 million over 5.5 years. The second NGO is World Vision, along with the real biggie, Barrick Gold. This is in Peru, and that's $1 million over 3.5 years. And then the third partnership is WUSC with Rio Tinto Alcan for a total budget of $928,000. And if memory serves me correctly, that's in Ghana, and that's a project over 3 years. So in all of these instances, CETA is kicking in money, and then the NGO and the mining company that have been brought together for these projects are kicking in a counterpart amount of money.
Right. Now, why are they doing this exactly?
Okay, so that is the million-dollar question, or I guess the $26.7 million question.
I guess it was raised about the lack of government funding now for NGOs. I guess that's...
Well, I think certainly I see two things going on here. There is no question that there is a shrinking pool of development aid money available. So there are all these NGOs that are competing for less and less money. Certainly under the Harper government, that's become particularly flagrant. So certainly that is an issue, and it puts the NGO community really under the gun. And I think while many NGOs are scandalized by this concept and refuse to have anything to do with it, there are clearly some that have been prepared to jump into bed with the mining industry as a way of obtaining ever scarcer funds. So I think that's one side of the story, fairly straightforward. I think the other side of the story is that the mining industry has been incredibly successful in thwarting any attempts to regulate it. And I see this whole alliance as part of that whole process and demonstrates the degree to which the Harper government really is there to facilitate the mining industry. Now, let's just back up a little bit. Some time back, there was a roundtable put together on the Canadian extractive industry working overseas in developing countries. And this was an initiative. This ended up bringing on board NGOs, academics, some players within the extractive industry, rights activists, came together, looked at the situation of the activities of Canadian mining companies overseas, and clearly came to the conclusion that something needed to be done to rein in the most egregious abuses being committed by some of these companies, and that it was not enough to have voluntary codes of conduct, it wasn't enough to have corporate social responsibility programs and all of this, that in fact these companies had to be monitored in a meaningful way, and they needed to be held legally accountable for human rights and environmental abuses. So those are the conclusions that came from this pan-Canadian work done by all of these groups. A report was submitted to the government of the day, and it was essentially watered down to the point where it basically didn't, all the teeth were taken out of it, and then it was ultimately shelved and never saw the light of day. Now, during that process, that roundtable process that mobilized Canadians across the country and really looked deep and came to this conclusion that regulation was what was required, a number of mining companies set up a parallel process and managed to encourage some NGOs to be involved in this process. And they came up with an alternative arrangement, which is that mining companies should partner with NGOs to work on corporate social responsibility projects in the various communities where they were working. And that is the initiative that saw the light of day. And so what Canadian mining corporations managed to do, and certainly hugely facilitated by the Harper government through this money from CETA, was to say, we don't need any kind of regulation. What we'll do is we'll pair with NGOs who are clearly legitimate players on the global scale, and we'll have them come in and do great projects, train people and deal with water and all of this kind of things. And then you see we're not so bad after all. We're obviously open to progressive change, and so there really is no need to bring about any kind of meaningful regulation. And that's where we are today. And the big joke, as far as I'm concerned, is on the Canadian taxpayer, because somehow we've ended up in a strange situation where we are subsidizing Canadian mining companies in whitewashing their activities in the various communities. It's just, it's amazing to me.
How do you mean that Canadian people, Canadian taxpayers are subsidizing it? You mean like it's just
normally,
huge government subsidies are basically going to them?
Well, the CETA money is Canadian taxpayer money. I mean, it's you and me and everybody else who works in this country that funds Canadian international development overseas. And so it is that money.